So I know everyone's tired, so I'll try to keep everyone awake by saying something crazy and, you know. Yeah, I know it doesn't sound like an appropriate topic for a cosmologist, but actually I take heart from the fact that two of the most pioneering papers on this topic were by cosmologists. First, there was Schrodinger's famous book, What is Life?, which was the sort of inspiration for both Watson and Crick and convinced Crick to switch into biology. And then the pioneering first paper on the genetic code was by George Gamow, great paper, two paragraphs long. Very beautiful, and a drawing of his. But okay, so, and an important thing about both of those, that book and paper were, they were largely crazy and wrong. So that's it's a part of the game, unfortunately. So you can expect that here also. Okay, so what's the idea? So let me remind you quickly. This is a project that I got interested in right at the beginning of the winter holidays, and. Just got obsessed with it then, and then by the beginning of January, I had begun to think it was actually interesting. I don't necessarily say it's right, but okay. What's the idea? So let me remind you how the genetic code works. So you know your DNA is a string of written in a four-letter alphabet, okay? Which let me call them A, B, C, and D. So it's some random string of four letters, and then. And then this is read in triplets. Every time an ABC occurs, a certain amino acid is associated with it. Every time a DDC occurs, a different amino acid is associated with it. And in this way, you get a string of amino acids which bind together to form a protein. And so there's some table which translates each of the 64 triplets, which can occur in your DNA, into one of the 20 amino acids that occur in your proteins. And so that table is the genetic, is what I'm calling the genetic code. Okay, so this is somehow, this very simple table is the basic table that encodes the translation of your genetic material into the actual machinery of your cells in basically all existing living organisms. And so the way you read the table here is, you know, this is the first letter. I wrote A, B, C, D there, but normally the RNA letters are actually U, C, A, G. So The row tells you what the first letter in the triplet is, the column tells you what the second letter in the triplet is, and then within each box, this is the third letter in the triplet. So for example, here this is telling you that serine, the amino acid ser, is coded for by UCC. Okay, that's there. Okay, so it's somehow this very simple fundamental aspect of life. You know, the basic point is that the first, if you ask even the most basic questions about it, the answers are not known. So, you know, why is your genetic material written in four letters? Why is it read in triplets? Why are there 20 amino acids? Why are the 20 amino acids not randomly distributed, but have sort of certain obvious patterns in their distribution in the table? What order did they enter the table in? None of these questions really have answers or not agreed upon answers. Okay, so, well, so Gamow, let's see. So Gamow gave a famous argument. He was the first person to guess that the code was read in triplets, and his argument went like this. He looked in the biology books of his day and found that the amino acids the proteins known at the time contained 20 amino acids, and he said, okay, and he knew that the DNA had four letters after Watson and Crick. This was right after Watson and Crick discovered the structure of DNA. And he said, okay, so if it was a singlet code, it could only code for 4 amino acids, so that's not enough. If it was a doublet code, it could code for 4 times 4 amino acids. Again, not enough. And so the simplest possibility that's sophisticated enough to code for 20 amino acids is a triplet code. Okay, and so that was his argument, you know, legitimate or not, for guessing correctly that it was a triplet code. Now, it turns out, actually, that we now know that of the 20 amino acids that appear in the genetic code, you know, actually 10 of them occur abiotically. You see that you find them in meteorites that fall down to Earth. They're made in these so-called Miller experiments, where you just mix up some elementary. You make any sort of simple reducing mixture, like with methane and ammonia, and you zap it with, you know, anything. You zap it with electricity. You zap it with UV radiation. And 10 of these guys get produced in abundance, but the other 10 don't get produced. And instead, they only seem to be produced in living organisms. So presumably that's saying that that the 10 that don't get produced abiotically came into use later, had to evolve. So there's 10, so it seems likely that there were a primordial 10. I'll tell you which those were in a minute, but just to say that, you know, if you just apply Gamow's same argument to the primordial code, you would have said, oh, well, actually, the simplest thing that would work would have been a doublet code. So that's one kind of argument for a doublet code. And then a second, equally non-rigorous argument for why you might suspect that the early code might have been a doublet code is just that, it's a famously vexing problem how to get this relatively complex machinery of life going. You know, somehow early on there was just inorganic muck, and then somehow the clockwork started ticking, and it sounds very hard to accomplish that. And the simpler and smaller the starting point, the easier it sounds. So you might naturally think that a doublet code, that a triplet code might have been preceded by a doublet code, but Crick early on gave a famous argument claiming a no-go argument, claiming to rule out that possibility. I'll just quote him here. He says, "It might be argued that the primitive code was not a triplet code, but that originally the bases were read one at a time, giving 4 codons, then 2 at a time, giving 16 codons, and only later evolved to the present triplet code. This seems highly unlikely since it violates the, quote, principle of continuity. A change in codon size necessarily makes nonsense of all previous messages and would almost certainly be lethal." So this has been taken to be a convincing argument. So you don't find any subsequent papers in the literature proposing that our triplet code was preceded by a doublet code. And so, you know, his argument here is basically, suppose that we did start with a doublet code and we learned to read this string in doublets. Okay, and we learned by reading this string in doublets to make some useful, it evolved to make some useful protein. And then, if you think about it, suppose some mutation happens along the way so that now you can start reading in triplets. So you can start recognizing maybe 1 and then 2 and then 3 of the triplets appearing here and attaching different amino acids to them. Well, any way you slice it, it looks like it's going to create chaos. You know, it looks impossible to convert a meaningful string that was written in the doublet language into a meaningful string that was written in the triplet language without going through a period of nonsense in between. You know, so for example, if this guy that used to read CD now mutates and becomes a guy that can only read CDD, well, then every time you see a CDD, suddenly you get thrown out of the correct reading frame. The other doublet guys get thrown out of the correct reading frame, and the rest of the message goes to hell.
It's why not one and then three?
What?
Why not one and then three mutated to three?
Why not one and then to three?
Yeah, instead of going to doublets and then.
Oh, well, so the same argument that he's applying to ones, the same argument, his argument would seem to apply for going from n to m. I mean, it's not about the particular numbers. So it's just saying that that if you learn to read a meaningful string in one chunk, then if you try to start reading it in a different chunking, you need many coherent mutations all at the same time to convert that original string with a given meaning into the newly chunked string and have it have the same meaning.
So isn't Muhammad right that this shifting of your reading frame isn't a thing if you m is an integer multiplier of n, or more properly n divides n.
Well, I said reading frame there, but let me get to discussing the reading frame. See, I gave Avery an earlier version of this story earlier today. So you're getting ahead of me, Avery, you're getting ahead of me. So what I wanted to say, I think if you think about it, that what Crick's argument is true if you imagine what he's imagining, that what you're trying to do is take a region of your DNA which had evolved to become meaningful, to become a meaningful protein in one language, and reinterpret that DNA in a new language by a series, turn that protein, convert it into this new language as if you were taking a piece of software that runs on one operating system and porting the same piece of software to a new operating system. I think it's okay to do that with a computer, but if you want to do that by a series of random mutations, you can't do it without death in between. But what I want to point out is that there's a different way. There's a loophole in his argument, which is that, you know, if you look at your DNA today, well, maybe not your DNA, but maybe your. So if you look at any of our DNA today, you know, only like 1% of your DNA, you know, some small region is actually coding for proteins. Most of it more than half of it is apparently not being used for anything, or in any case, we don't know what it's being used for. It's not coding for proteins. So imagine that at early times, that it was like that you learned to make useful proteins on some region, let's call it region one, of your DNA. But then you begin to learn to make triplet proteins on some different, previously unused region two. Okay, so over here you begin to learn to make new proteins. Okay, so it's not that you're learning to make this old protein in this new language, no. The doublet region can just go on making its own its old proteins as before. It's just that the triplet region is going to start learning to make some new proteins. Well, then that wouldn't run into Crick's problem. And the question is just, the next question is, what's a plausible mechanism for making that happen? Or why would one expect that to possibly happen? So in particular, you know, if I begin evolving triplet readers over here, triplet tRNA molecules, what's to stop them from coming over? What's to stop the triplet, the guy that binds to ABC over here from coming over here and binding to ABC when it occurs over here and wreaking havoc in region one, or vice versa? What's to stop the guy that reads BC over here from coming over and binding to BC over here and wreaking havoc in region two? You have to find some reason for them to not read one another in order to make this mechanism work. Okay, so that brings me to the next thing which I wanted to explain, which is what comma-free codes are. Okay, so at the, So, comma-free codes, well, there was, right after right after the discovery of the double helix, George Gamow wrote the first paper on how to, people didn't know what the, how the code worked. How was it actually translating into proteins? So as I say, he guessed it was triplets. And his original idea was that the triplets were being read by like this, an overlapping. So ABC was one amino acid, and then BCC was coding for the next one, CCB, et cetera. And people quickly realized that couldn't be right. Okay, so then they figured out that it had to be getting read in triplets that were adjacent to one another. But then the question arises, okay, well, let's say this is the correct way to read it. How does the code know not to read it in an incorrect way? How does it know not to read it this way? That would be, if this is the so-called right reading frame, this would be an example of a wrong reading frame. Or this way, this would be another wrong reading frame. So Crick had a clever idea about that. He said, well, maybe what's going on is that only a subset of the available triplets actually are sense codons. Only a subset of them code for amino acids. And that subset is we'll call it comma-free if, when we read, if we take a string of those sense codons, if we read them in the correct frame, each of the triplets is one of the sense codons, which does code for an amino acid. But if we try to read it in any of the wrong frames, these will all be nonsense codons. They won't meaningfully code for any amino acid. And he realized that if you do that, well, so for example, then AAA can't be a sense codon, because if you put it next to itself, well, then you could read it in the wrong frame and still get another sense codon. So you have to rule out AAA. And by the same argument, you have to rule out BBB, CCC, DDD. So of the original 64 triplets, that rules out four of them. And then he said, OK, but also, if you look at ABC, let's say ABC is a sense codon, does code for an amino acid. Well, if you imagine putting two of them next to each other, then that's saying BCA had better not be a sense codon, and CAB had better also be nonsense. So for any given triplet that is allowed, you have to rule out its cyclic permutations. And so of these 60 that remain, you can only take one third of them. And so you get 20 as the maximum number in a comma-free code. So he said, oh, this looks like a very elegant explanation for simultaneously how does the cell know how to read it in the right reading frame and how to get 20 amino acids. And
Yeah, but he has a problem now because you have to also have start and stop, right?
Well, no, not here. No, you just stop having start, as long if you have a string of sense codons, and then at the end you just don't have sense codons anymore. Then you know the idea is just stop is just when you start having nonsense codons.
The other 44, you're saying
exactly.
Start or stop.
Exactly. So okay. So now this turns out to not be how the code works today. Okay, nowadays we know that actually, this idea is wrong, because you know actually what we have today is like I showed you before, almost all 64 codons are in use. Almost all 64 triplets are in use, not just some subset of 20 of them. But Crick remained fond of this idea and emphasized that maybe it's not what happened today, but maybe it's not how things were today, but maybe this is how the code worked initially. And there, beyond the fact that this seems to give a nice explanation for the number 20, there's two other reasons to think that maybe this is a more likely primordial mechanism. One is just that it seems it is that it's just less sophisticated than the way things are actually done in the cell today. So in the cell today, what happens is that you have a start codon, which tells you where the message, where the protein starts. So fine, that sounds simple enough. But then, you know, a protein will be thousands of codons long. And so fine, you start in the right reading frame, and then you read this triplet, and you read this triplet, but you know, biology is not a computer, you know, it makes mistakes all the time, and so it begins to jump, you know, it'll skip a guy by mistake and jump and get into the wrong reading frame. And so in order to have it still be in the right reading frame, 1,000 codons downstream, nowadays there's an elaborate error correction mechanism that that corrects errors as they go along, including frame shift errors. So it's plausible that today's, like with many things in evolution, the thing that one does today is a more efficient and more sophisticated, but not the original mechanism. And the other thing to say is that if you look at where the 10 primordial amino acids lie in the code, whoops, sorry, that's the wrong way. So here I've colored the primordial amino acids blue, and the remaining ones are the ones that only came later. Well, the start codon is met, and that's one of the more complicated amino acids that did not occur primordially. So, you know, it's not a surefire argument, but it's another bit of evidence that that the start codon is something that came along later in the process. So, what I want to imagine is that this comma-free idea did take place at earlier times.
When you say primordial, you mean that are produced in the Miller experiments, or you mean
that? Well, it turns out that the same 10, you find the same 10 in a bunch of different places. But yeah, you find them in the Miller experiment, in all sorts of different variants of the Miller experiment, find the same 10 amino acids. And then also, if you look in meteorites.
Sure, right. But that's what you meant.
That's what I mean by that, yeah. Also, if you look at the chain of reactions that build up amino acids, there's also 10 that occur at the beginning of the chain of the reaction chains, and it's the same 10. Okay, so let's see. So what I wanted to say was that if the original codes were comma-free, then it gives a very neat explanation for why region 2 and region 1 could evolve independently of one another and not mess with one another, which is to say they would do that if these two codes were not only comma-free, if the doublet code and the triplet code that began to evolve afterwards were not only both comma-free, but if they were mutually compatible in the sense that no matter how you try to read this string, if you try to read it with the doublet code, it's pure nonsense. And similarly, vice versa, if you try to read this code with the triplet readers, with the triplet tRNA molecules, it's pure nonsense. Okay, so that's what I mean by a compatible comma-free codes. And so the nice thing is that it ends up connecting the triplet code that we see today, if this is right, to an earlier doublet code that might have preceded it in a rather restrictive way. So in particular, there's not that many comma-free doublet codes. You can enumerate them. And then for each doublet code, there's not that many compatible triplet codes you can write down. You can enumerate all of those. And so you can write a little Mathematica code that goes through and enumerates them. And due to lack of time, I'll just maybe show you a couple of results. Okay, so here's an example of a doublet code. Here's an example of a doublet code, CACGAG. Okay, and it turns out it has two maximal compatible triplet codes, and I've shown them with black dots where they lie. Let me explain one more thing, sorry. Because of time, I'm not really gonna have a chance to explain it, but there's two, well, right? I think so.
Yeah.
So
the brush,
okay, sorry. So the blue guys here, I've colored in the primordial guys. Now there's another way to slice up the amino acids that also seems interesting, which is what's shown here. the red guys, the pink guys. So these are, it turns out that when people ended up, people, there's, for each amino acid, there's a specific enzyme that attaches it to its corresponding tRNA molecules. And it turns out that the 20 enzymes break into two classes, which are evolutionarily not, appear to be not completely unrelated to one another. So they've been sequenced, and this 10 are all related to one another, this 10 are all related to one another, and they seem completely independent of one another. And moreover, one set of 10 are enzymes that attach smaller amino acids to their tRNA molecules, and then the other one attaches larger analogs. So another thing which has been speculated, but this is, I would say, more speculative, is that the class of 10, which are associated with the smaller amino acids, also are in some sense evolved earlier, and then the other amino acids associated with the other set of 10 enzymes came into the code later. So that earlier set, according to that criterion, are the pink ones here. And so in the next, and so here I've just shown them overlaid on one another. So the purples are both, okay, that early by both of those criteria. And so then I'm just showing here for this doublet code to the two associated triplet codes, maximal triplet codes. And you know, they do pretty well. So this example, so we end up getting this one has 8, I believe, amino acids in it. Eight triplets in it. So all six of the, there are six amino acids that are overlap, that are early according to both categories. They're all included. And then there's one more, which is early according to the primordial criterion, but not according to the enzyme criterion. And then another, which is vice versa. And then another example, and then there's the other code, which, where it codes for 9 amino acids, and 8 of them are primordial according to the Miller experiment criterion, meteorite criterion, and then the 9th is early according to the other one. So it's saying basically this, it seems to be saying that this, well, first of all, there are examples that seem to be in some sense in reasonably good agreement with what you would hope if this theory were right, but I don't want to say any, I don't at all think it's like they agree so well that it's convincing evidence that this works. But on the other hand, you can work in the other direction and say, you know, if it does work, if this is right, then it seems among all the 3-word doublet codes you can come up with, it seems to favor this one, for example. And so it seems to be a way to kind of look back to a small number of candidate doublet codes, which seem the most likely given the triplet code that we see. So that's it. There may be one other thing to say is that it also gives a nice explanation for where 4 letters comes from, which is just if you assume that you started with a doublet code, which evolved to a triplet code via this comma-free mechanism, you can't. It turns out to be impossible if there's less than 4 letters. So 4 letters is the simplest possibility that allows comma-free triplet codes that are compatible. And also, you can't get simpler. You can't have started with a singlet code. That also is not compatible with any larger code. So yeah, gives new perspective on some of these questions, and maybe is a new ingredient in what actually went on. I don't know. You'll be the judge.
I had a question. Why the special doublet code doesn't involve you? So that seems to be.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's actually an interesting thing about it. Well, so this is just
that in as a constraint that emerged.
No, that's right. I looked for the triplet codes that fit right. This was, for example, the triplet code that gave the maximum number of primordial guys. Mm-hmm. It is interesting about this that it's known that C and G bind much more strongly than A and U. This is the most tightly bound doublet code you could have written down in the sense that it involves that's comma free. But so that's
There's all kinds of circumstantial evidence.
Yeah, I don't want to overstate it, but it does seem like it's a little, it's an interesting puzzle with a lot of little pieces and only partially through fitting them together. It's interesting though. Yeah.
So as I understand, there's a lot of junk DNA, which is not currently being used.
That's right.
Probably that evolves differently from the used DNA, because if there's a modification of the junk DNA, then who would notice? So given this formation story, is there any way in which we could check it in the junk DNA? Because that could be a historical archive of this whole formation story.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't see it, but maybe, yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Exactly.
Yes, that's true.
Right. So a lot of errors.
It mutates, therefore, then quickly, right?
Well, it's all the same code, so.
Right, but the coding logons have a protection to not mutate as quickly, whereas. Ones that are actually used in your.
If you're saying if the ones that are actually being used, if you mutate, you're more likely to kill yourself, basically kill your prodigy.
True. Reading and writing mechanism. I'm not sure.
No. I think that's true. I think it, in the actual reading and writing, that's even the junk data is error corrected when it's but I think that it's just the fact that you die, your prodigy, your progeny, I should say, die more, not prodigy.
So if we went through these different stages of two-letter and three-letter codes, shouldn't we see organisms that have these different reading systems? Because, is it true that all organisms we see now are using all the amino acids?
Yes. So every organism today, today, all organisms that are alive on Earth today, as far as we know, use essentially exactly this code and all 20 amino acids. There are very tiny, it's very hard to evolve this table once it's in place because, you know, if I suddenly came along, let's say I had a mutation in my tRNA, which whenever the triplet CUG came along, instead of reading Lu, I read alanine or something like that. Well, this triplet occurs like at 10 million different places in my DNA, in my genome, in an encoding position. So I'm toast. I mean, it's like having 10 million simultaneous mutations. So for that reason, it's very hard to evolve the code, and you see almost no evolution. Although actually, for example, in all vertebrates like you and I, our mitochondria have evolved a couple of changes here. But it's so that there's various cases where small branches of the tree of life have evolved small mutations, but no more than a couple of changes. To your basic question, the picture, which I didn't get a chance to say, is that, you know, so with a doublet code, you can code for at most, a comma-free doublet code can code for at most 5 amino acids. But then if it codes for 5 amino acids, it turns out it's so restrictive on the triplet code that the triplet code can only code for 2 amino acids. So it's triplet code is too dumb to take over from the doublet code. If you instead have the doublet code only code for 4 amino acids, then the triplet code can code for 6. And if you code for only 3 amino acids over here, like in my example, then the triplet code can code for 9. So the idea is that the doublet code was good enough to get started, but it only had 3 amino acids available, so it couldn't make very fancy proteins. So it was good enough to get things going, and it deserves a medal for that. But ultimately, the triplet code came along and was just got eventually, when it was using 9 amino acids, was just so could do so much better that it just completely took over, and the doublet code fell by the wayside. And then the compatibility constraint goes away, and the triplet code can evolve beyond this initial 9.
Yeah. So there's some piece of this that's like a lot like gray codes, right?
And like what codes?
Gray codes. This is I think they're called gray codes. It's a way of fault tolerant encoding in memory, where you're using extra bits to check the prior bits, right? And so if a sequence of bits is nonsensical, right? You know that something bad has happened to it, and even better than that, I think the classic example, you encode a fifth bit, which tells you what the other four should have done.
Error correcting codes.
Yeah, right, right. So the whole mathematics, computer science associated with that, and it sounds very similar. But one thing that leaps out at me this in here and there as well is that you should be able to compute a Shannon entropy of DNA or something like this.
Yeah, so people have done that, and it's not optimal as an error correcting code. But so it's actually better than sort of a random code at being robust against errors, but it's by far not optimal. In particular, if it was optimal like that, you would find that you would get things like in a normal, when you're normally coding, words that are used more frequently are coded by shorter lengths, and ones that are used less frequently are coded by, well, that's a more of an efficiency thing, but anyway.
But if you had a triplet code, you would have a prediction for what the entropy was, right? Because you'd not have the nonsensical choices, and I can't help but suspect that the triplet code is going to have is going to be more efficient than the doublet code.
Higher entropy.
Yeah.
More robustness against errors.
Well, but also
that's one of the reasons maybe why one no longer has a comma-free code but has this more degenerate code where many different, because now, it turns out, for example, that the third base is the one that binds the weakest to the tRNA. So it's the one where there's the most likely to be misread. But when this whole box here is all the same amino acid, that means a misreading in the third codon doesn't lead to any error in the amino acid that gets inserted. So it does look like it has that subsequent so-called codon capture, subsequent encode capture of previously non-used triplets. I'm arguing that back in the early days, maybe only these nine triplets were used, but then over time, all these other 60, all these other 55 triplets, or nearly all of them, did get incorporated into the code, and they got incorporated in such a way as to possibly minimize errors in the transcribed amino acids.
Hunt through genomes and do what Laura was or answered Laura's question directly. There are sections in the junk DNA that are doublet code that's just left over, or that are actually the triplet code that are left over. Those sections should have a different entropy than the DNA where you really have a start and stop position and the fancy error correcting mechanisms to permit you a broader variety of encodings.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting idea that if you look through the junk DNA, it would be somehow correlated with the appropriate doublet code. I mean, I think DNA can mutate very rapidly. I mean, DNA, not rapidly, but, so you're your DNA, every time it's copied, every base has a 10 to the minus 8 probability of having an error. So over billions of years, I think DNA mutates a lot. It's unlike the table, where it doesn't mutate. Like Neil was saying, there's no evolutionary pressure to stop the junk part of your DNA from evolving at the natural rate of 10 to the minus 8 times the
washing
out the original message. So I have a feeling it would be washed out, but I should check that. Yeah, easy to check, right?
Whether it's random or not. Mm-hmm. It also presumes the junk DNA is junk.
Yes, that's true too.
It isn't actually.
Yeah, that's right.
I've heard people say that something like 25% of it is playing a regulatory function, and then the remainder is currently thought. Well, no one knows what it's doing. Let's put it that way.
So viruses, and I mean, for example, insert themselves. Mm-hmm. Some toolkit apparently that's used, by organisms. Hmm. If they want to mutate, mm-hmm. in some way that's advantageous. Well, that's the story. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Spare tires.
Okay, I think let's thank all the speakers.
All right.